Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for today, Tuesday, April 2nd, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Dale Finnegan and Doug Kretzinger. And now here's Doug with our first story.
And the first story on the top of the page, or one of the first stories, this one is entitled Temporary Channel Opens at Bridge Collapse Site. Written by Lei Skene, S-K-E-N-E, and Tasani Yajapanska. It's an Associated Press article. Baltimore is the dateline. The U.S. Coast Guard has opened a temporary alternate channel for vessels involved in the clearing of debris at the site of the collapsed Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore, part of a phased approach to opening the main channel leading to the vital port, officials said Monday. Crews are undertaking the complicated work of removing steel and concrete at the site of the bridge's deadly collapse in the Patapsco River after a container ship lost power and crashed into a supporting column. On Sunday, dive teams surveyed parts of the bridge and checked the ship, and workers in lifts used torches to cut above water parts of the twisted steel superstructure. Officials said the temporary channel is open primarily to vessels that are helping with the cleanup effort. Some barges and tugs that have been stuck in the port of Baltimore since the collapse are also scheduled to pass through the channel on their way out of the harbor. Authorities believe 4 workers plunged to their deaths in the collapse. Maryland Governor Wes Moore said at a Monday afternoon news conference that his top priority is recovering the 4 bodies, followed by reopening shipping channels to the port. Said he understands the urgency, but that the risks are significant. He said crews have described the managed steel of the fallen bridge as chaotic wreckage. We have to move fast, but we cannot be careless, he said. U.S. Coast Guard Rear Admiral Shannon Gilreth said divers examining the steel girders beneath the surface found them tangled and intertwined, making it difficult to figure out how to cut and lift them out of the water. What we're finding is it is more complicated than we hoped for initially, Gilreth said. Moore said crews used a large crane to lift a 200-ton span of the bridge, a task that took 10 hours. He said the piece was considered a relatively small lift compared to what's to come. The scale of this project, to be clear, it is enormous, and even the small lifts are huge, he said. Moore said crews will lift another 350-ton piece from the bridge later Monday as weather allows. Officials earlier said the temporary channel, would have a controlling depth of 11 feet, a horizontal clearance of 264 feet, and a vertical clearance of 96 feet. This makes an important first step along the road to reopening the port of Baltimore, Captain David O'Connell, the federal on-scene coordinator of the response, said in a statement Monday. By opening this alternate route, we will support the flow of marine traffic into Baltimore, he said. 2 additional larger channels are planned as more debris is removed from the waterway, which officials said would allow more maritime traffic to resume. They declined to provide a protected timeline for those channels being opened. Earlier Monday, the governor and other state and local leaders met with members of the International Longshoremen's Association, Local 333, which represents port workers whose jobs could dry up while shipping is suspended. President Joe Biden will visit the collapse site Friday. White House Press Secretary Jean-Pierre announced Monday. He will meet with state and local officials and get an on-the-ground look at federal response efforts, she said. Moore said he expects the president will leave with a better understanding of the task at hand. He's going to see the fact that we have a ship that is almost the size of the Eiffel Tower, that weighs about as much as the Washington Monument, that's in the middle of the Patapsco River, Moore said. He's going to see a bridge that has been in existence since I was alive. I don't know what that skyline looks like without the Key Bridge, and he's going to come and he's going to see it sitting on top of a ship. Also Monday, the Small Business Administration opened 2 centers in the area to help companies get loans to assist them with losses caused by the disruption of the bridge collapse. Yvette Jeffrey, a spokesperson for the agency's Disaster Recovery Office, said affected businesses can receive loans for as much as $2 million. She said the effects, could range from supply chain challenges to decreased foot traffic in communities that depended heavily on the bridge. The bridge fell as the crew of the cargo ship Dali lost power and control March 26. They called in a mayday, which allowed just enough time for police to stop vehicles with driving onto the bridge, but not enough time to get a crew of 8 workers off the structure. 2 workers survived. 2 bodies were found in a submerged pickup, and 4 more men are presumed dead. Weather conditions and the tangled debris underwater have made it too dangerous for divers to search for their bodies. The Dali is managed by Synergy Marine Group and owned by Grace Ocean Private Limited, both of Singapore. Danish shipping giant Maersk chartered the Dali, which was on its way out of port when it lost power. Synergy and Grace Ocean filed a court petition Monday seeking to limit their legal liability. It is a routine but important procedure for cases litigated under U.S. maritime law. Federal court in Maryland will ultimately decide who is responsible and how much they owe. The filing seeks to cap the company's liability at roughly $43.6 million. It estimates that the vessel itself is valued at up to $90 million and was carrying freight worth over $1.1 million in income for the companies. The estimate also deducts 2 major expenses, at least $28 million in repairs and at least $19.5 million in salvage. Along with clearing the shipping channel to reopen the port, officials are trying to determine how to rebuild the major bridge, which was completed in 1977. It carried Interstate 695 around southeast Baltimore, became a symbol of the city's working-class roots and maritime culture.
I'm going to read this article from the front page of the Quad City Times titled, From Wheels to Walls. There is a photograph, actually, too, but the large one shows co-owners Archie, Nisha, and their son Arcaris Bragg, B-R-A-G-G. They're standing behind the counter of their new Bragg Barbecue restaurant in East Moline. That you can see the counter in front of them and some soda machines in the background. And they are wearing logoed polo shirts and smiling for the camera as they open their new restaurant. This article is written by Gretchen Teske. The Bragg family started with 4 wheels and is moving into 4 walls with Bragg BBQ, the restaurant. Archie and Nisha Bragg are the husband and wife duo behind Bragg BBQ, a popular food truck in the Quad Cities. Along with their son, Arcaris Bragg, the trio is expanding their operations and opening a brick-and-mortar location at 905 15th Avenue in downtown East Moline. Cooking, especially barbecuing, has always been a tradition in the Bragg family, with Archie behind the smoker. Once the COVID-19 pandemic set in, the family noticed restaurants were closing, but the demand for food was still high. With years of experience cooking for family, the Braggs decided to buy a food trailer and try their hand at being business owners. Things were shutting down, and from the looks of it, it didn't look like COVID was going anywhere anytime soon. And it was just a good fallback plan to have because the truck could be out, Nisha said. Even though it was the height of winter in January, it got good reception and steadily picked up reception, end quote. The first day Bragg BBQ hit the road was historic for 2 reasons. It kicked off a successful business in the Quad Cities, and big things were happening in Washington, D.C. We opened up on Inauguration Day, actually, Archie said, a real cold day on January 20, 2021. That was our first day taking the food truck out, and it was a learning process and an experience. But we had a really good reception from the public even then. So we just grew from there, end quote. At the time, the couple's son, Arcaris, was a cook in the Air Force. He consulted from afar, and once he came home, jumped in to help his parents right away. As it turns out, his assistance was a big help, as customers tend to clear the Braggs out of food before closing time. Once it started to grow, there was no shutting the faucet off, Archie said. The trailer is typically parked in Davenport at the Northwest Bank Tower parking lot, where their loyal fans line up to get a bite. The slogan on the side of the trailer reads, "Follow us for flavor." It's a promise, Nisha said, that customers know the family keeps. We have about five things that tie for first place, she said. The menu at the trailer will be the same at the new restaurant, with dinner options including ribs, brisket, and turkey legs, which come with two sides and bread. The a la carte and snack menus offer smaller portions of mostly the same items, including turkey or rib tips, pulled pork sandwiches, and a half or full slab of ribs, all prepared on site and made to fall off the bone. Everything is smoked. We don't fry anything, and we don't even do fries, Nisha said. As the restaurant gets going, they hope to expand the menu over time. But until then, they're sticking with the classics that include sides like smoked mac and cheese, candied yams, baked beans, greens, and coleslaw. On the dessert menu, the Braggs serve up slices of peach or apple cobbler for $5 a piece while they still have it. The food sells out fast, and it's not because of expensive advertising. Word of mouth is what has grown the business, and it starts in line at the trailer. Another thing I hear a lot when they come to the trailer is, "What's good?" Nisha said. "You can't go wrong with anything, so just go down the menu. Every time you come, just try something different." As the customer base grew, so did the demand for a sit-down restaurant. Customers continuously asked, and the Bragg family started looking. With his day job being in downtown East Moline, Archie took a liking to the building with the military mural on the side. With it being essentially turnkey and already fit for a restaurant, it was a true no-brainer, Nisha said. "It seemed like this building was just made for us, especially with that mural out front," Archie said. "With me being in the Navy and Arcaris being in the Air Force, it's like it was calling at us." The Bragg BBQ food trailer will continue to be in operation until the grand opening of the restaurant on April 12th. From there, the family will shift the focus to the East Moline location. Once things are running smoothly downtown, the trailer will be out Thursday through Sunday, with each day being designated for a different city to help, quote, spread the love and make it easier for customers to access, Nisha said. The restaurant will operate the same days, with tentative hours being Thursday through Friday, 3:30 to 8 p.m., Saturdays from 1 to 8 p.m., and Sundays from 1 to 7 p.m. Updates to the menu and hours can be found on the business's Facebook page. While the family learns the ropes of the restaurant business, the food will all be served prepped for carry-out. But customers can stick around and eat their carry-out in the dining room. Although it's a big step to move from a trailer to a restaurant, Arcaris isn't worried at all. The three of them have put in the work to get themselves to this point and are ready to share it with the community. Now, instead of opening the window, they get to open the doors. "Our menu is amazing, so I'm not really nervous. I'm just excited to see how much we can grow," Arcaris said. "To actually have a spot that we can call our own and be the first in the family to have our own restaurant is amazing," end quote.
Also on the front page, there's an article, and its headline is "Speech-Language Pathology Program Earns Accreditation, Augustana College." Olivia Allen, Quad City Times, wrote this. Earlier this month, Augustana College's Master of Science in Speech-Language Pathology, MSLP program, and earned full accreditation. The designation is granted by the American Speech Language Hearing Association, ASHA. For Augie, the proceeds started with the college launched when the college launched the MSLP program in 2020. "We were confident accreditation was going to go well," said Allison Haskell, director of Augie's MSLP program. "But of course, it's an important milestone in building a program, so we were very excited," she said. The accreditation process involves several documents, meetings, and site visits to show the program will have adequate staffing, facilities, and results. "You have to show all the program indicators," Haskell said. "While the status won't change, Augie's MSLP degree it's an expectation of graduate level programs. I think most employers would want to hire from an accredited program, you know, because there are standards the program has to meet that are aligned with ASHA's vision, Haskell said. Augie's first cohort of MSSLP students graduated in May of 2022. Since the program was in a pre-accreditation phase during this time, Haskell said these students' degrees were still certified under ASHA. When programs are in a candidacy phase, the students still can get their credentials like they would from a fully accredited program, she said. It's really more than the program is under the microscope. Haskell thinks accreditation will help track more students to the program. I'm guessing that it'll help with recruiting, she said. When you're fully accredited, that gives students, I think, the confidence that it's a little more of an established program. Augie's MSSLP program includes academic coursework and clinical work at the Barbara A. Roseman Center for Speech, Language, and Hearing on campus. Students in the program also complete semester-long externships in the Quad Cities or nationwide and can graduate with more than 400 clinical hours. Olivia Book, a second-year student from Kansas City, Missouri, said Augie's MSSLP faculty made the program stand out. They go above and beyond to help students and make an effort to get to know you. I knew I picked the right program when I showed up to orientation and had my own personalized clipboard to use in the clinic, made by our clinic coordinator, Lisa Adner, she said, adding, Haskell made homemade cookies for her cohort during midterms. The staff always pushes us to be our best. They're also incredibly supportive throughout our time there. You know, they care about you and your success, she said. Book feels assured by program's accreditation status. As a student, it's a great feeling to know that your school is actively trying to create the best program for you, she said. Additionally, Book said, Augie's MSSLP faculty constantly take input from students on how to improve the program. Haskell said Augie's undergraduate SLP program was very well established for over 8 decades, but that you really do need a master's degree to practice. She said the local and regional need for SLP services is strong. All of our MSSLP students have gotten hired post-graduation, Haskell said. Many of our students have their job identified before they graduate. Definitely the need is high. According to the U.S. Department of Labor, SLP employment is expected to grow 19% from 2022 to 2032, much faster than average for all occupations. As she pursues postgraduate job opportunities, Book said she is prepared for the SLP practice exam and any externships. I feel super prepared with the base of knowledge and range of experiences Augie has given me, she said. Moving forward, Haskell is expected to shift the focus to growing and improving Augie's MSSLP program, which is exploring new summer externships opportunities. Next summer, for example, a group of Augie MSSLP students will compete an externship in Cambodia. Now that we're in this phase, we can start working on some of those more exciting things. We're thrilled to do that, she said.
I'm going to turn to the local page of the Quad City Times. There are a couple articles here from the local section. Plea bargain offered is one of them. This is written by Thomas Geyer. Man is charged in connection with overdose death. And here is the story. One of two people charged in connection with the overdose death of a 25-year-old Bettendorf woman in October of 2023 has tendered a plea offer for consideration by the court. Lucas Matthew Seitz, age 33, of LeClaire, is charged in Scott County District Court with one count each of involuntary manslaughter, possession with the intent to deliver less than 5 grams of meth, possession with the intent to deliver 5 grams or less of fentanyl, and conspiracy to commit a non-forcible felony. Seitz was arrested February 16th along with Nicole Danielle Tucker, age 33, in connection with the death of Kayla Slusser, who overdosed on the morning of October 14th, 2023, in a room at the City Center Motel in Bettendorf. Slusser died 3 days later while in hospital. According to the plea agreement, Seitz will plead guilty to the charges of possession with the intent to deliver fentanyl, a Class C felony that carries a prison sentence of 10 years, and involuntary manslaughter, a Class D felony that carries a prison sentence of 5 years. Seitz is asking the court to sentence him to 5 years of probation on each charge, with the sentences to run at the same time. He also is requesting that the meth delivery and conspiracy charges be dismissed. The agreement stipulates he will complete programming at the residential correctional facility and complete a substance abuse treatment program and follow through with aftercare. The agreement also stipulates that he will be responsible jointly and severally liable with Tucker for victim restitution in the amount of $150,000. Seitz's plea hearing is scheduled for 2:30 p.m. Wednesday in Scott County District Court. Tucker also faces the same charges as Seitz in connection with Slusser's death. Tucker also has other cases pending in Scott County District Court. She is charged with first-degree theft, a Class C felony, for allegedly being in possession and driving a stolen U-Haul van on October 28th. She also is charged with driving while barred in that case. Tucker also is charged with third-degree burglary for allegedly breaking into and stealing items from a Bettendorf home on October 30th of 23. A pretrial conference is scheduled in each of those cases for 1 p.m. Friday in district court. Both Seitz and Tucker were each being held Sunday night in Scott County Jail on a cash-only bond of $100,000. I'll also read this other short story. Woman found dead in Moline. She had been reported missing on Sunday, and this is written by Gannon Hennevold. A woman was found dead in the 3400 block of 7th Street in Moline early Monday morning. A passerby called 911 around 4:30 a.m., requesting a welfare check for a woman lying on the side of the roadway, Moline police said in a news release. The Moline Police Department found a 45-year-old woman deceased. The woman had been reported missing by her family on Sunday afternoon, police said. The location of the investigation is near Hamilton Elementary School. Hamilton families were still able to enter the school's parking lot for drop-off, as police did not believe there was any risk to the school or neighborhood, a district spokeswoman said. Police said the circumstances of the woman going missing were not considered suspicious. Police are investigating the circumstances around her death. The woman had a, quote, significant medical history, police said, but her exact cause of death was unknown as of Monday morning. Traffic on 7th Street and 32nd to 36th Avenue was briefly detoured this morning, reopening by 7:27 a.m., police said. Anyone with information is asked to contact the Moline Police Department at 309-797-0401.
And staying with the local section of the paper, honoring National Donate Life Month is the heading on this story, written by Gretchen Teske. More than 170 million are registered as organ donors. Each April, the Iowa Donor Network, IDN, joins its colleagues across the nation in observing National Donate Life Month, NDLM, a nationwide initiative highlighting the critical need for organ, eye, and tissue donation. NDLM serves as a platform to honor the generous donors and their families who have transformed lives through the gift of donation, while also raising awareness about the importance of registering as a donor. This year's National Donate Life Month emphasizes the profound impact of donation, showing stories from over 100,000 patients awaiting transplants across the nation and the legacies of more than 1 million recipients and their families. It also acknowledges the selfless acts of donor families who, in moments of grief, choose to give the gift of life to others. Furthermore, NDLM recognizes the over 170 million individuals who have registered the decision to be donors, extending hope and healing to those in need. As the designated organ procurement agency for the state of Iowa, Iowa Donor Network remains committed to its mission of transforming lives through the gift of organ and tissue donation. Throughout the month, IDN aims to inspire Iowans to register as donors, educate healthcare professionals on the donation process, coordinate recovery efforts, and provide ongoing support to donor families. "We are dedicated to fostering a culture of donation within Iowa," said Heather Butterfield, IDN's Director of Strategic Communications. National Donate Life Month serves as a poignant reminder of the life-saving impact of donation and encourages individuals to register as donors, ultimately providing hope to those awaiting transplants. The public can join Iowa Donor Network and Donate Life America in commemorating National Donate Life Month by participating in the following ways. Registering as a donor. Iowans can register as organ, eye, and tissue donors at iowadonornetwork.org. And sharing the message. Help spread awareness about the importance of donation. Follow Iowa Donor Network on all social media platforms and share its messages. Joining in celebrations, engage in key celebrations throughout April to support the Donate Life cause, both online and in your community. Visit iowadonornetwork.org/events to find events in your area. Illinois residents can sign up for donation to the Gift of Hope Foundation.
I'm going to go ahead and read this one story from the health section of the Quad City Times. The title is Seasonal Symptoms. The subheading, How to Keep Pollen from Ruining Your Spring as Allergies Strike. More than 80 million Americans deal with itchy eyes, runny nose, and other symptoms of seasonal allergies, according to the Asthma and Allergy Foundation of America. The level of misery people will face depends on where they live and what they're allergic to, but there are things you can do to feel better. Dr. Rachna Shah usually starts looking at pollen counts in the Chicago area in April, but she peeked at her data in mid-February and noticed tree pollen was already at a moderate level. "The season has been so nuts," said Shah, an allergist and director of the Loyola Medicine Allergy Count. "Granted, it was a pretty mild winter, but I didn't expect it to be so early." Shah said she believes this season will be longer than other years, assuming the weather remains warm. Experts say climate change has led to longer and more intense allergy seasons. There are three main types of pollen that cause seasonal allergies. Earlier in the spring, tree pollen is the main culprit. After that, grasses pollinate, followed by weeds in the late summer and early fall. Some of the most common tree pollens that can cause allergies include birch, cedar, cottonwood, maple, elm, oak, and walnut, according to the Asthma and Allergy Foundation of America. Grasses that cause symptoms include Bermuda, Johnson, rye, and Kentucky bluegrass. The best and first step to controlling allergies is avoiding exposure. That's easier said than done when everyone wants to enjoy spring weather. To prevent allergy issues, keep windows closed at home and in the car. Avoid going out when pollen counts are highest and change clothes when you get home. Pollen trackers can help with planning. The American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology tracks levels through a network counting stations across the country, and those counts are available at their website, which is AAAA, that's 4 A's, i.org. They do have a couple of treatments that you can try. One is Claritin, some non-drowsy antihistamines, and decongestants like Sudafed, or you can try nasal steroid sprays as well to help combat those symptoms. You are listening to the Quad City Times on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. I'll turn it over now for the obituaries. We do have a lot, so we'll probably skip the um, You know what I mean, Doug. Okay.
Yes, we do have quite a few obituaries, so they'll be abbreviated to a degree today. I'm going to begin with Arlene K. Dahlman. Arlene Overholzer Dahlman died on March 25 in Pontiac, Missouri, where she had moved to be near her son, Stephen, and daughter-in-law, Lisa Dahlman. Arlene was born and raised in Miamisburg, Ohio. She attended Miami University for 2 years and received a temporary teaching certificate during her first year of teaching. She met and married Lowell Richard Dick Dahlman, a student seminarian who was serving as an intern pastor at St. Jacob Lutheran Church, Arlene's home church. Their wedding at St. Jacob's was standing room only. Wonderful beginning for the couple who were married for 61 years. And she made the best of the many moves Dick's career required. She graciously served and supported others as an at-home mom, pastor's wife, Sunday school teacher for 26 years, and volunteer English tutor for immigrant children and adults, and long-term visitor to those unable to leave their homes. Arlene also continued to teach. She returned to study at Concordia Teachers College in River Forest, Illinois, to complete her BA degree in 1979. And here's one on Ruth Jean Rensberger. That's 99, passed away on March 30th at the Fountains in Bettendorf. Celebration of Life services will take place 11 a.m. Saturday, April 6th at Wirtz Funeral Home. Visitation will begin at 9:30 a.m. and conclude at the time of service. Ruth will be laid to rest at Davenport Memorial Park. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to Tunnels to Towers online. Condolences and fond memories may be expressed at weertsfh.com. Family extends their thanks to the staff at the Fountains Cascade Unit for their loving care of Ruth in her later season of life. And here is Alice Sandberg, 103 of Davenport, passed away Easter Sunday, March 31, at the Clarissa C. Cook Hospice House in Bettendorf. Visitation will be held 4 to 6 p.m. Friday, April 5, at City View Celebrations at Trimble Point, located in the lower level of Trimble Point, 701 12th Street, Moline. Memorial service will be 1:30 p.m. Saturday, April 6, Grace Lutheran Church in Davenport, with a reception following the service. She will be buried in the columbarium wall at the Rock Island National Cemetery, Rock Island Arsenal. And she was born in Rock Island in 1920, the ninth child of Emil and Helena Pugh Bent, who each had immigrated to America from Hamburg, Germany, as young children in the 1880s. And she married in 42 Harold R. Sandberg in Rock Island. She has a lot more to say here in this article about family and everything, but it ends up by saying the family thanks the entire staff at Classica C. Cook Hospice for their compassionate care and invites friends to share condolences at TrimbleFuneralHomes.com. Roland Bechtel, B-E-C-H-T-E-L, age 85, of Clinton, passed away Wednesday, March 6, at home. And following Roland's wishes, cremation rite will be accorded. Graveside service will be held on April 6th at Clinton Lawn Cemetery at 2 p.m. and the celebration of life will be held on April 7th at 2 p.m. at Mr. Richard Beckel's home in Mill Ridge, Clinton, Iowa. The Pape Funeral Home is assisting the family. Roland was born in Boone County on February 8, 1939, son of Lovell and Ethel Sailor Bechtel. His education was complete by eighth grade, and he did obtain his GED. Roland entered the U.S. Navy at 17. He served for a total of 7 years overall. At the time of active discharge, he was on board the USS Cambria APA 36, and his rank was an FN E3. And Roland was very proud of his time in service and loved sharing his stories about serving our country and was an active VFW member. Military funeral honors will be rendered. And online condolences may be left at papefh.com. Cards and flowers will be maybe sent to Kenny Bechtel and Margaret Zimmerman at 2721 North 2nd Street in Clinton, Iowa, 52732. I'll read one more here before we go on to the next page or so. Angela Bechtel. Wow. Same name. Age 79 in Clinton, passed away Thursday, February 22 at the Alverno. In following Angela's wishes, cremation rites will be accorded. A graveside service will be held on April 6th. Clinton Lawn Cemetery at 2 p.m. and the celebration of life will be held on April 7th at 2 p.m. at Mr. Richard Bechtel's. Well, my gosh, these must be husband and wife. No, I didn't know that till now. The Pape Funeral Home is assisting the family. So Angela was born in Clinton on February 13, 1945, the daughter of Lee and Margaret Lewis Telford. She graduated from Clinton High School in 1963 and attended the University of Iowa to study music. Angela married Roland Bechtel on June 15, 1968 in Clinton. They were married for 55 years. And she was a member of Assumption Greek Orthodox Church in East Moline. And it says here, our mother took pride in her Greek heritage. Angela loved spending time with her family over the years, loved all of us unconditionally. Our mother ensured we kept our family traditions that her mother passed on to her. It's been our honor as her children to care for her at her home over the last few years. Our mother truly loved being YIA. I don't know what that is. And it ends here by saying, again, ongoing condolences may be left at papefh.com. Cards and flowers, you send to the same one, they'll both get it. Cards and flowers may be sent to Kenny Bechtel and Margaret Zimmerman, 2721 North 2nd Street in Clinton, Iowa. And I'm going to turn it over to Dale.
William D. Freese, known as Bill, passed away. A memorial service for William Freese will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, April 6th at Holy Cross Lutheran Church, located at 1705 East Locust Street in Davenport. The family will greet friends at the church from 9:30 to 11 a.m., and the service will be live streamed. A luncheon will follow at the church with a private interment burial at Oakdale Memorial Gardens in the afternoon. Memorials may be made to the Davenport Schools Foundation or Holy Cross Lutheran Church. Mr. Freese died December 23rd, 2023, at home following a brief illness. You can see a complete obituary at the website weertsfh.com. Helen Christopher, age 77, of Moline, passed away Friday, March 29th at Unity Point Health, Trinity, Rock Island, after a courageous battle with cancer. Private burial is in Rock Island National Cemetery under the direction of Trimble Funeral Home in Moline. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to Moody Radio Quad Cities, which is WDLM. Drawing from her own experiences as an immigrant, she dedicated her life to assisting others in similar circumstances throughout her long and devoted career as an ESL educator. Helen's career spanned across various educational institutions, including the Moline and Rock Island school districts, where she tirelessly worked to empower students with the language skills needed to thrive in their new environment. Additionally, her commitment to extending the Black Hawk Area Education Center and the Dyslexic Learning Center were noted. A woman of faith, Helen found solace and community at Heritage Church in Rock Island. She was also a member of the Black Hawk Hiking Club, where her love for the outdoors flourished. Helen found joy in the simple pleasures of life, particularly playing tennis, pickleball, exploring nature, hiking, bird watching, and gardening. Above all her passions, however, Helen held her family closest to her heart. She was a devoted wife, mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother, finding profound joy and purpose in nurturing and supporting her family. The family invites friends to share stories and condolences at TrimbleFuneralHomes.com. Vicky Jean Carrington, age 71, of Atkinson, passed away on Saturday, March 30th, at her home. Cremation rites have been requested, and a memorial service will be held at 7 p.m. on Friday, April 5th, at Vandemore Funeral Home and Crematory, Atkinson Chapel. Reverend Terry Lancaster will officiate. A memorial visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. prior to the memorial service at the funeral home. Memorials may be directed to St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. Vicki was born August 5th, 1952. She was the first of seven children. She graduated from Atkinson High School, received a bachelor's in applied management technology, and a master's in business administration from St. Ambrose University. She received a master's of science in contract management from the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. She was employed as a contract specialist officer for the Department of the Army at the Rock Island Arsenal. On April 25, 2009, she married Gary Carrington in a service held at Chapel on the Hill in Geneseo. Vicki was a former member of St. Anthony Catholic Church in Atkinson. She enjoyed raising dogs, horses, and even a few cows, quilting, and traveling. And she loved spending time with her family. And finally, Dr. Lorraine Marie Rodriguez Fisher, age 79, of Galena, Illinois, formerly Davenport, died Thursday, March 28th. Services are at 9 a.m. Friday, April 5th in Christ the King Chapel at St. Ambrose University in Davenport. Friends are requested to join the family in wearing Clemson orange or Clemson Tigers clothing to the service. Burial is in Rock Island National Cemetery. Memorials may be made to Viva Quad Cities. Lorraine Marie Rodriguez was born March 22, 1945, in Danbury, Connecticut, to Alvaro and Alice Rodriguez. She married Edward D. Fisher in 1966. He passed away in August of 2010. Lorraine earned her undergraduate degree from University of Bridgeport, master's degree from South Florida University, and Clemson University College of Nursing, before going on to earn her doctorate of education from Clemson. She was a professor at the Clemson University College of Nursing before moving up the academic ranks, serving as associate professor of nursing at the Medical College of Ohio, dean of nursing at both Carlow College in Pittsburgh, PA, and Grand Valley State University in Allendale, Michigan. She was vice president of academic and student affairs at Maryville University of St. Louis before concluding her career at St. Ambrose University, where she was the first female officer for the university and served as academic vice president until her retirement in 2008. She was a fan of Clemson University sports teams. She enjoyed arts and crafts, crocheting, and loved her dogs over the years.
Yeah, opinion section time in the paper, the Quad City Times. I'm going to read this one. It's another view, Orlando Centennial. And it says, crisis in Haiti requires more than airdrop. Florida must stop flow of guns, ammunition to island nation as it descends into anarchy. Across central Florida, Haitian Americans watch their relatives and friends suffer in a constant state of fear, anarchy, and hopelessness. Their homeland's government is no longer functioning. Food and water are scarce. Armed gangs, some 200 of them, control the capital. They have burned police stations and freed more than 4,000 criminals. Gang members slaughter Haitians at random and have forced thousands to abandon their homes. They have looted hospitals and shut down commerce. They demanded and got the resignation of Prime Minister Ariel Henry, leaving no one to receive the multinational policing force, led by Kenya, that he had arranged with help from the United States. The nation has been without a president since Jovenel Moïse was assassinated 3 years ago. People fear being shot on sight if they venture out to search for what food there may be, says Florida State Representative Mary Woodson, Democrat Hollywood, who was born in Haiti and still has family there. My country is in chaos and people are dying, Woodson told the Sun Sentinel editorial board. I've never felt so helpless and so hopeless. She's urging the Biden administration to airdrop food to the people, as it did in Gaza. That's a good idea, but much more needs to be done. President Joe Biden needs to revive the multinational force, which involves no U.S. troops, and persuade congressional Republicans to free up a $40 million contribution they are blocking. Republicans say the details are vague and that the aid could wind up in the wrong hands, and those are valid concerns that Biden must address. But others are more direct action. Every lost day will mean desperate refugees crowding into small boats to try to reach sanctuary in the U.S., where an anti-immigrant Governor Ron DeSantis may be waiting to dash their hopes. Haitian advocates are terrified that DeSantis means to use the Florida State Guard, which the legislature unwisely reactivated, to intercept desperate Haitian refugees and send them back to Haiti to die. DeSantis is talking about a special legislative session to pass a law like Texas enacted, allowing its officers to arrest people simply for being undocumented immigrants. Legislative leaders should reject that idea. Our nation's responsibility toward Haiti isn't merely that of a good neighbor. It's complicated by what a bad one we are in facilitating the arming of the Haitian gangs. As with the drug cartels in Mexico and Central America, the U.S. arms industry is effectively their silent partner. DeSantis should use his influence and state resources to stop the flow of guns and ammunition from Florida to Haiti. U.S. arms traffickers are pouring gasoline on Haiti's flames. It's time to quench the fire, put them out of business, and restore order where anarchy now rules. But anxiety is growing daily that it may be too late.
There is a political cartoon today drawn by Steve Breen. It shows former President Trump and President Biden standing in the background, both in suits, just standing, looking fairly stern. In the foreground is a drawing of Robert F. Kennedy from about the chest up. He is wearing a doctor's white lab coat. He's got some tongue depressors in his pocket, a stethoscope around his neck, and a button on his chest that says RFK Jr. He's holding a syringe that says votes on it and smiling as he says, "I'll give one of these guys a booster," referencing, of course, Trump and Biden. And now here is another opinion, this one from Eugene Robinson. Trump's Bible grift is going to backfire with the faithful. Donald Trump could be making a big mistake hawking the God Bless the USA Bible to his MAGA supporters. Some of them might actually read it. This latest grift might well flop, like Trump's steaks and those hideous gold-colored Never Surrender sneakers he's trying to sell for $399. For its opportunistic timing alone, the rollout happened during Holy Week, the most sacred time on the Christian calendar, the Bible venture deserves to be smitten by a wrathful marketplace. If the MAGA faithful do buy those Bibles and look inside, however, they will find myriad reasons to forsake their profoundly flawed political hero. They need only read as far as Exodus 20, in which Moses comes down from the mountain and pronounces the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not commit adultery is an injunction Trump has bragged about habitually violating, as heard on the Access Hollywood tape. In that same recording, he also boasted about violating another commandment. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. Trump is scheduled to be tried in a New York courtroom next month on felony charges that stem from a brief sexual liaison with adult film star Stormy Daniels. At the same time, he is appealing an $83 million civil judgment against him for defaming writer E. Jean Carroll, whom he sexually abused in a department store dressing room, according to the court's findings. I could go on and on. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor is yet another commandment Trump routinely ignores. Of the tens of thousands of documented lies he has told, many have been falsehoods about his real or perceived enemies. In recent days, he has been telling lies about the daughter of the judge who presides in his impending criminal trial, and who angered Trump by issuing a gag order prohibiting him from lying about witnesses, prosecutors, jurors, and court staff. Of course, the commandments are found in the Old Testament, where God's judgment can be harsh and definitive. The New Testament tells us what we all are, tells us that we all are sinners and that we all can be saved. That is the theological basis on which Trump's unlikeliest loyal followers, evangelical Christians and their pastors, justify looking past the way Trump scoffs at so many of the Bible's instructions. And this next paragraph is in italics. Yes, he is far from perfect, they tell themselves, but like all of us, he can find salvation through Jesus Christ. As we give him our campaign contributions and our votes, we can also pray for his redemption. And that's the end of that little quote. Anyone who forks over $59.99 for a God Bless the USA Bible and reads it, however, will see that Jesus, whose resurrection Christians celebrate on Easter Sunday, gave detailed instructions for believers to obey. They are encapsulated in the Sermon on the Mount as related in Matthew 5 through 7. And this is a quote from Matthew 5 through 7. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth, Jesus said. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. End of quote. That's pretty much diametrically opposite of the MAGA creed, which is more like, just win, baby. Later in the sermon, Jesus says, agree with thine adversary quickly while thou art in the way with him, lest at any time the adversary deliver thee to the judge, and the judge deliver thee to the officer, and thou be cast into prison. End quote. Had Trump followed this legal advice, he would be facing fewer criminal trials and civil fines. On another occasion, described in Matthew 25, 42 through 46, Jesus gives clear instructions about what a righteous immigration policy should be. Here's that quote. I was hungry and you gave me no food. I was thirsty and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger and you did not take me in, naked and you did not clothe me, sick and in prison, and you did not visit me, he says. And the dire consequences of behaving this way is, quote, to go away into everlasting punishment, end quote. Evangelical voters and their pastors, who presumably know in detail what the Bible says, have effectively suspended their belief in Jesus' words. They cite Trump's willingness to lead their crusade against abortion, though it is one issue Jesus never addressed. Toward the end of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus does give a warning that could not be more relevant as Trump seeks to regain power. In quotes here, beware of false prophets which come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravening wolves, end quote. Again, that opinion was from Eugene Robinson, who writes for the Washington Post.
Sports section time, Clark Hawkeyes Cleveland bound, Iowa earned second straight trip to the Final Four, this article. And they won 94-87 victory on Monday night. Article about guess who? Miss Clark. But I'm going to read a short article here to get through most of it. Bluter leads Hawkeyes back to Final Four. It's about the coach. Lisa Bluter is probably known best as Caitlin Clark's coach. But while most credit for Iowa's success over the past 2 years has been heaped on the program's 6-foot superstar on the court, Clark and the other Hawkeye players give credit to the 62-year-old mentor on the sideline. Bluter has been a head coach since 1983-84, first at St. Ambrose in Davenport, then back in Des Moines before taking over the Hawkeyes 24 years ago. She's racked up 882 wins, has coached Iowa to 8 straight 20-win seasons, 2 straight Final Four appearances after the Hawkeyes 33-4 defeated LSU 31-6 in the Elite Eight Monday night in Albany. Coach Bluter is a Hall of Fame coach, Clark said. I think the biggest thing for me throughout the recruiting process that I loved about her is she's a player's coach. She's not going to have a set offense that you have to run. She's going to tailor everything to what she has on her team and what's going to put her team in position to be very successful. She was the Naismith National Coach of the Year in 2019, the year she coached another National Player of the Year in Megan Gustafson. But much of her success has gone under the radar. Longtime assistant Jan Jensen, who played for Bluter at Drake, has been on her Iowa staff since 2000. She called her boss one of the good guys in women's basketball. She's a coach who got into the profession when there was no money or fame involved, swept the floor, did all the things right, drove the vans, has really, I think, done a lot behind the scenes to continue pushing women's basketball forward, Jensen said. Bluder describes herself as a basketball lifter, the kid who took over the family hoop that was built for her brothers and had her dad move some bushes so she could shoot from further out. She's also great X's and O's coach, Jensen said, echoing Clark's point that Bluder is able to adapt to any style that best fits the strengths of the team she has at the moment. She has run everything from triangle to a basic motion to the current read and react system that is designed to get Clark the ball in the best position possible, Jensen said. And it went on to say, we talk about growing the game. Look at their fan base, Mulkey said. The coach of Louisiana said, I just have much respect for what she does with her players. I think the sign of a great coach is you adapt and you adjust to the personnel. And it ends up by saying, she really instills great values in us, and she believes that every single person on our team matters, said Kate Martin, who has spent 6 years under Bluder at Iowa. It doesn't matter if you're Caitlin, who plays 40 minutes a game, or if you're somebody who doesn't really get off the bench. Every single person on our team matters. Dale?
That's wonderful to hear. But that brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. I'm Dale Finnegan, and my partner at the microphone has been Doug Kretzinger. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at our website, iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.